Welcome to the inaugural shiur of Aksava, Kabbalah, and Parshas Bereishis, as we typically do. So we want to start a little bit with the biography of the author of the Aksava, Kabbalah. So we'll talk a little bit about his background, about his biography. We'll read from his introduction to the Sefer a little bit about what he sees the aims of the commentary as being, and then after all of that, we'll actually try to learn some of the Aksava Kabbalah on Parshas Bereishis. The Sefer Aksava Kabbalah was authored by Rav Yaakov Tzvi Mecklenburg. He was born in 1785 in the town of Lissa, the town that ultimately became famous as being the place where the Nesivos HaMishpat served as the Rav. And basically, we don't know so much about his childhood, which is interpreted as a sign that he mostly sat and learned. You know, there weren't too many stories about what he was doing because he was learning. He was learning. So sort of a dearth of stories. He actually decided initially to go into business. He was uninterested in supporting himself financially from Torah. Until the age of 46, he served as a businessman. Apparently, the business went sour. And around the same time that the business went sour, the town of Königsberg in Prussia offered him the Rabbanus. Again, he had a reputation as a tremendous Talmud Chacham, notwithstanding the fact that he did not serve professionally in a rabbinic capacity. So at the age of 46, he switched careers, left the business world, and became a Rav, and basically stayed in Königsberg till his death at the age of 50 in the year 1865. At the age of 80, in the year 1865. When Rav Mecklenburg arrived in Königsberg, he found that Königsberg at that time was already experiencing some of the winds of change that were blowing through Europe at that time. The influence of what would be described as the Haskalah, the so-called Enlightenment movement, was already making its way through Königsberg. And, many of his constituents saw themselves as much more rationalistic, much more enlightened, you know, than the traditional commentaries on the Chumash and the like. And in particular, they had a hard time accepting much of the rabbinic interpretation of the Torah Shebiktav. We'll see the words of the author of Aksava Kabbalah themselves in just a few moments, but essentially part of what was current at that time among the thinking of many people was that Chazal might have interpreted the Chumash in a certain way, but that doesn't really necessarily reflect what the Chumash actually means. And if that's the case, so then we don't need to be bound by what Chazal understand the Chumash's meaning. As an extension, we need not see ourselves as being so bound by Yiddishkeit as a whole. Rav Yaakov Tzvi Mecklenburg was a tremendous defender of tradition and of Chazal, and he authored the Sefer Aksav VaKabbalah in part to show how the Torah Shebiktav and the Torah Shebaal Peh, the written Torah and the oral Torah, fit together as one seamless whole. And that's really the title of the Sefer, Aksav VaKabbalah. It has nothing to do with Kabbalah, or, you know, if you came here tonight thinking that you'd walk out knowing how to build a golem by the time we're done, so you're probably going to be disappointed, although, you know, you never know, the last 5 minutes of the shiur, I always like to mix things up a little bit. But, the meaning of Aksav VaKabbalah is that the Ksav, the Torah Shebiktav, and the Kabbalah, the tradition, you know, the Torah Shebaal Peh, really go together. In other words, if you understand the Chumash properly, you'll see that all the things that Chazal interpreted as coming out of the Chumash really are in the pshat, in the simple reading of the Chumash itself. We're going to see as we go through the Aksav HaKabbalah through the course of the year that the author was tremendously erudite in a vast literature. It goes without saying that, you know, the classic literature you'd expect him to be conversant in, you know, the Talmud, the Midrashim, you know, the classic Rishonim, the medieval commentaries, that goes without saying that he quotes left and right. But he quotes the Zohar and a lot of Kabbalah very frequently. which again is interesting. He quotes a lot of contemporary works, you know, writers of that time who were just coming out with things on Chumash, which obviously he was very well versed in. He quotes the Vilna Gaon a tremendous amount, which again is interesting. It was not a Talmud of the Vilna Gaon, and the Vilna Gaon had lived not so much before the Sefer Aksava Kabbalah was printed, but many of the Chidushim of the Vilna Gaon we only know through the Haksava Kabbalah. In other words, he was the first one to make these Chidushim of the Vilna Gaon well known. Notwithstanding that fact, the author of Yaakov Tzvi Mecklenburg was incredibly humble. There's a letter that he wrote to Rav Eliyahu Guttmacher, who was one of the great Gedolim of that time. Rav Eliyahu Guttmacher wrote him and said, you know, I heard you came out with the Sefer, could you send me a copy? And basically, Rav Yaakov Tzvi Mecklenburg writes back and he says, I'm flattered by the request, but, you know, I wrote my Sefer for the common, simple people, just to help them understand the Chumash. A Gaon of your stature, Rav Eliyahu Guttmacher, doesn't need a simple Sefer like mine. And, you know, I appreciate the request, but to be honest, there's really no point. Nonetheless, he writes, I'll send you my commentary on Brachos, just so that, you know, you ask me something, I don't want to turn you down. You know, the Gemara says, Ein Misarvin L'Gadol. A great person asks you for a favor, you don't, ask you to do something, you don't reject it. But nonetheless, he honestly did not see himself as being worthy of having his Sfarim being read by someone of the lights of Rav Eliyahu Guttmacher. He saw the Sefer as basically, a very simple Sefer just to teach the common man what the Chumash meant. Again, I think as we go through the Sefer during the course of the year, we'll have reason to dispute the author's self-evaluation, but it stems from this tremendous modesty that he had, that he really couldn't see what was so special about what he was writing. Nonetheless, in the very letter to Rav Eliyahu Guttmacher, the author writes, I've heard that there are some places where they actually learn my Sefer every Shabbos afternoon as part of going through the Parsha, again, in his own lifetime. And he seems very surprised by that fact as to why would anyone, you know, make it a point to learn my Sefer. I was really just writing very simple things, you know, for people to try to understand what the Parsha was all about. Let me share a few of the words of the Mechaber, of the author himself, in his introduction, where he lays out what he's hoping to accomplish with the Sefer. Writes Rav Yaakov Tzvi Mecklenburg in his Hakdama, in his introduction, there are numerous things in the Pshat, in the simple reading of the Chumash, that are very hard to understand on the surface. So one of those things he writes is Oson Mikraos Hamarim Maisim Bilti Neosim Umisnagde Hayosha La Anoshim Chusei Hamadrega Afkila Avos Haolam. There are stories that are described about the Avos in Sefer Brachos that seem that portray the Avos in a very, very negative light. And they seem to be the sort of things that if we heard that other people were described as doing these things, we would be utterly turned off by that description. And certainly it seems strange and troubling to see Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Yosef, the Shvatim, being described and engaged in that kind of behavior. So of course a couple of examples, right? Avram and Sarah go down to Mitzrayim. Avram says to Sarah, pretend that you're my sister, not my wife, so that I don't get into trouble. So far, okay, at least it's understandable. Says Avram to Sarah, Laman, Yitavli ba'avurech. And I'm hoping that because you pretend that you're my sister, so they'll treat me nicely and give me gifts. And says Rabbi Yaakov Tzvi Mecklenburg, I mean, what kind of lowlife says something like that? You know, pretend you're my sister so that they give me gifts. Seems very strange, right? The whole episode of how Yaakov quote unquote steals the birthright from Esav, very hard to understand. The Shvatim throwing Yosef into a pit, and you know, at the outset, considering killing him, and then just settling, compromising on selling him into slavery. Reuven, again, according to the simple pshat in Chumash, having relations with his father's concubine, Bilhah, all of these things, says Rabbi Yaakov Tzvi Mecklenburg, if you were to read about them in the newspaper, you would say, these are lowly people. So how can it be that the Avos HaKadoshim are described as being involved in this kind of behavior? So that's one thing he says I want to try to explain in my commentary. You just read pshat, and you walk away very troubled about the image that you have of these great forefathers of the Jewish people. And again, he's not just speaking spam. This was apparently something that was expressed to him by many of his constituents, that we don't understand how we can hold Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Yosef, the Shvatim in such high esteem when they seem to be doing acts which are so difficult to understand. A second thing, says the Ksav HaKabbalah, we find numerous expressions describing HaKadosh Baruch Hu that seem to be describing Hashem in very humanistic terms. God is a kelkana. He's a jealous God. God gets angry. God gets upset. Under God's legs is something that looks like a sapphire brick, right? When they go up on Har Sinai, right? I hear the cries of Bnei Yisrael. God is described over and over again in what seem to be very human-like terms. And I'm sure many people came to Rabbi Yaakov Tzvi Mecklenburg and said, you know, this image of God which is presented by the Chumash doesn't seem to be an image of a deity. It seems to be describing God, Lahavdil, as Lahavdil, like a Greek God or something of that nature, you know, or something which lacks the true divinity that we associate with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So how are we to understand that? He goes on to say that he wrote his commentary in part to try to address these questions. I mentioned the second point because the very first piece we're going to see tonight is a very fascinating idea that Rabbi Yaakov Tzvi Mecklenburg presents to try to understand so many of the Lashonos, so much of the language that we have in Chumash that describes Hashem in human terms. We're probably all familiar with the fact that since the Targum Onkelos, there's been an attempt to seemingly reread those words, as being metaphors as opposed to being understood literally. You know, when it says that God, got angry and Vaychar Af Hashem, in other words, God's nostrils flared. That's not meant in a human sense. When we say that God regretted, that's not meant in a human sense. These are all terms that are meant just to help us understand on our level, what HaKadosh Baruch Hu was doing, at a particular time. That's a standard interpretation that goes back to the Targum Onkelos, and the Rambam in his Mor Nevuchim very much extols the Targum Onkelos for making those kinds of translations of the various Pesukim. Rabbi Yaakov Tzvi Mecklenburg presents what I think is a very unique way of dealing with all of these issues, and that's what I want to start with tonight. So, in Perek Beis of Breishis, Pasuk Chaf Gimel. So the Chumash says that after Chava is created, Adam refers to his new wife as Isha. Let's look at the pasuk for a moment. He calls her woman. Vayomer ha'adam, man said, Adam said, Zos hapam etzem me'atzomai uvasar b'mesari. This one is bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. L'zos yikare Isha, ki me'ish lukacha zos. This one shall be called Isha, woman, because she is taken from Ish, from a man. Comments Rashi, Lashon Nofel al Lashon, clearly the word Isha is meant to be related to the word Ish. Mikan Shenivra Ha'olam B'Lashon HaKodesh. Rashi comments, we see from here that the world was created in Lashon Kodesh using Hebrew. Hebrew was the original language, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu used Hebrew to create the world. Why? Because Adam HaRishon's play on words only works in Hebrew. It happens to work in English, but I don't think anyone really, you know, man and woman, but I don't know that anyone claims that English is the original language in which the world was created. No claim has ever been made to that effect, right? But the whole idea behind the pasuk that she's called Isha because she comes from Ish presupposes that the language that Adam HaRishon is using is Lashon Kodesh. Otherwise it doesn't work. If it would have been a different language, Menner, Freuden, it doesn't work. You know, the language just simply doesn't work at all. Okay, so says Rashi. Writes the Ksav HaKabbalah, he quotes Rashi, and he says, "V'zeh hefech das ha'omrim shaloshen shnitna bo tarasenu akdosha, hi heskemi." Rashi is saying the opposite of those who would say that language, and particularly Lashon Kodesh, is merely a human convention. Right? How do we develop language? So if you ask a social scientist, the social scientist will say human beings originally just grunted at one another. Right? You know, the language that we speak usually within the first 15 minutes of waking up in the morning. They first just grunted at one another. They shook their heads at one another. They made sign language at one another. And eventually human beings decided, oh, you know, we'll call this table. Table? Table. Good. Call this chair. Chair. Good. It's all a heskim. It's just a social convention where people agree to call certain things. Right? Every aspect of language, including Lashon HaKodesh, is simply a humanly developed social convention. When people think that way, they then get into a great deal of confusion. That then leads us to have problems when we have words that seem to describe God in human or material terms. Right? We know that the Rambam spends a lot of time to explain that words that are used to describe human beings are also used to describe the Ribbono Shel Olam and how that could possibly be. This all comes about because we see language as something that was invented by human beings to describe the human world around us. The Ein HaDvarim came. But that's not true, as Rashi says over here. Who invented Lashon Kodesh? God invented Lashon Kodesh. So in other words, God used these words to communicate to Adam HaRishon. He used these words to communicate to Noah, in Shem Ve'eva. Right? So in other words, the origin of Lashon Kodesh is from Shemaim. It's from heaven. Now, why is that significant? So he goes on to say as follows. This is really the point of Chiddush. Therefore, V'yicholes Hashem nikra yod, v'nichtav b'yud v'david. So therefore, he says, take a word like yad. What does yad mean? If you ask the average person, if we go out on Delancey Street, we stop five people, and we say, tell me, what does yad mean? So I assume the average person will stop, will say, yad means hand. Aye, so what does it mean when we describe Hashem as having a hand? Vayar Yisrael, vayar ha-gedola, asher asa Hashem b'mitzrayim. So we'll say, well, yad means hand, but when we apply it to God, it's a non-physical way of describing God's ability. They saw the great power that God wielded against the Egyptians. Says the Ksav HaKabbalah, you have it backwards. Yad doesn't mean hand. Yad means power. Because the Ribbono Shel Olam created the Hebrew language. And Yad means power. Because Hashem uses it to describe Himself. So now human beings, you know, are trying to use a word that would describe that which enables a human being to act with power. You know, that thing at the end of my other thing that helps me be powerful, what do we call that? Oh, let's call it Yad. Because the same way Yad is a way of describing Hashem's power, so Yad can also describe this thing that speaks of my power. It's not that Yad starts off being a hand and then we apply it in a non-literal sense to Hashem, it's that Yad starts off describing Hashem, and we apply it in a non-literal sense to parts of our body. The same thing. Hashkachas Hashem nikra ayin. When we talk about God's providence, the word for God's providence is ayin. Now, just as God has providence, in other words, He's aware of everything in the world, so to the extent to which we are aware of our surroundings is through our eyes. So let's call our eyes einayim. Right? But it's not that ayin means eye. Ayin means providence. It means hashkacha. It's just, you know, in human terms, the hashkacha that we have is referred to as an ayin. And it continues like that. Hashmas ritzon al zulaso nikra kol. When God makes his will known to others, that's called kol. Kuf vav lamed. Now, how do we make our will known to others? We express it through our voices. But kol doesn't mean voice. Kol means the act of communicating to others what you want. So when the pasuk says Vayishmu'es kol Hashem Elokim mishalech bagam l'ruach hayom, that the Adam and Chava heard the kol of Hashem, they heard, it doesn't translate they heard the voice of Hashem. They became aware of God's will. Right? It doesn't mean a voice. We use kol in human terms to describe a voice, but that's not what it means in its pristine form. In its pristine form, because Lashon HaKodesh comes min ha'el yonim, because it comes from heaven, it describes making one's will known. And that's what he goes on to say. Ein dover b'chol ha'torah kushlis yachsel Hashem yisparach shetei gashmas. You don't have to, when you look at it that way, the whole problem of anthropomorphism, you know, describing God's actions in human terms disappears, because we're not describing Hashem's actions in human terms. We're describing human actions and human things in divine terms. It's borrowed for human beings. So that's what he goes on to say. V'lachein gam kein ma shekostuv b'tzalmeinu yitochei levaro kipshuto ve'ein hefzid mizeh. This also explains one of the basic questions we have in the very beginning of Chumash. Hashem says, Nasa Adam b'tzalmeinu kidmuseinu. Let's make man in our image. Man is created in the image of God. Tzelem Elokim. Now, what does it mean that man is made in Tzelem Elokim? Again, obviously it can't be understood in a literal sense that we look like God. Says Aksav HaKabbalah. I'll tell you what it means. All of man's actions can be described in terms that originally were applied to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's the sense in which man is B'Tselem Elokim. You know, man has a Yad which somewhat approximates the notion of Yad by Hashem. Man has a Kol, the same way, you know, which somewhat approximates the notion of Kol by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that's the idea of B'Tselem Elokim. Yesh lano yad ve'ayin ve'peh v'shituf Hashem levad. Ki bohem hu yecholos v'ashkoch nikroim yad ve'ayin. We have all of these same terms that are used in terms of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but of course when it comes to us, they mean different things. Right? So he says, just to give one more example, inyan hashchino shetiskalu unavim b'makomus mischalfin nikroim raglov. Whenever we describe the Shekhinah appearing to the Nevi'im in different places, that moving appearance of the Shekhinah is called the Raglei Hashem, the feet of Hashem. Right? Now again, I'm using the word feet, but it's not really feet. You know, regel is a term that means the appearance of God's glory in different places. But since it's something that moves from place to place, in human terms, we describe, you know, we use the term rego to describe a leg or a foot, but it doesn't really mean that. So because of that, when it says regarding HaKadosh Baruch Hu in Sefer Zechariah, for Amdu Raglov Behar HaZeitzim, we have this as the Haftarah for the first day of Sukkot, that God's legs will stand in the future on Har HaZeitzim, and you know, we struggle to understand what that means. God's legs are going to stand on Har HaZeitzim. God has legs. You know, tachas raglov kemaisa livna fasafir. you know, they go up on Har Sinai and they see underneath God's legs. What does that mean? So again, raglayim vis-a-vis HaKadosh Baruch Hu just means the appearance of His glory. That's what it means. We use the term regel to mean a leg or a foot. Don't get confused by that. That's not what it means with regard to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Finally, he concludes with the following idea. We find that the Zohar says, and again, this is just another example of how, up until this point, Aksava Kabbalah is a grammarian, right? He's quoting the Mara Nevuchim, and he's talking about this word means this or it means that. Now, all of a sudden, it becomes the Mekubal, and he says, we know the Zohar says, Kol HaTorah Kula Shmosov Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Right? The entire Torah is made up of the names of Hashem. Right? The Ramban quotes this in his Hakdamah, his introduction to Chumash. The entire Torah is made up of the Shemos, of the names of Hashem. So what does that mean? So I think the way it's often understood is that if you take the words of the Torah and you sort of break up the letters differently than the way in which they appear, you will Kabbalistically get various names of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which then have significance. The Haksav HaKabbalah says, I think there's maybe a simpler way of understanding it. Kol HaTorah Kula Shmosov Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, all of the words that the Torah uses, all of the words that Lashon Kodesh uses in describing human activity, ultimately are words that are really meant to describe HaKadosh Baruch Hu. They are shemos, not names of God, right, in the sense of a proper noun, but they are common nouns. The nouns that we use for Yad, Regel, Ayin, and all these sort of things are really initially used to describe HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So Kol HaTorah Kula, the entire Hebrew language, is really Shmosov Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, is really utilizing terms that in their origin were meant to apply to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Hence the whole problem of anthropomorphism, of this notion that, you know, the Torah uses words that are human-like to describe HaKadosh Baruch Hu, just disappears in smoke when you look at it from the other perspective, that these are words that in their origin were meant to describe Hashem Yisbarach and not the other way around. That's a little taste of the Aksava Kabbalah, but as Hashem, after Ma'ariv, we'll add one more thought on a different topic in Parashas Bereishis, just to be mashlim the Indian prophet. Welcome to the second part of the Shir on Aksava Kabbalah and Parashas Bereishis. So, for the second part of the Shir, I want to string together, mostly outside, it's just too long to read inside, but a couple of ideas that the Aksava Kabbalah mentions with regard to the whole episode of Cain and Hevel. Right? So the basic story we know. So one point that the Haksav HaKabbalah makes right off the bat is that the respective professions of Cain and Hevel already tell us a little bit about who they are even before the episode with the murder. You know, one of the things that puzzles all of the Mefarshim is that, you know, Hevel and Cain bring karbanos, and Vayisha Hashem el Hevel ve'el ben Chasa, Hashem accepts the carbon of Hevel, He rejects the carbon of Cain. And in the text, it's not really clear why that should be so. Again, we're familiar with Rashi. Rashi brings from Chazal that Hevel brought the best, Cain brought, you know, yesterday's vegetables, you know, brought the stuff at the bottom of the pile. But again, if you just read the simple text, Haksav HaKabbalah is in the Pshat, you don't necessarily see any obvious reason why HaKadosh Baruch Hu should accept the carbon of Hevel and reject that of Cain. So the Haksav HaKabbalah develops the following interesting idea. He says, Nira ki roet son, hu shem toar l'chol ish ha-mufrosh midarchi ha-hamon, u misbodeid lolun b'mekomus barachokim ibnei Adam, bal yatridu amiu nehevle masvei anshe tevel. Hevel was literally a shepherd, but the kinds of people who go into shepherding, and as a more general term, the very term roet son, shepherd itself, speaks to a person who's very spiritual. And he goes on to say, you find that the great leaders of the Jewish people, certainly in the time of Tanakh, were shepherds, right? Yaakov Avinu was a shepherd, Moshe Rabbeinu was a shepherd, David HaMelech was a shepherd. Now, it's interesting, by the time you get to Chazal, a relatzon, a shepherd from the point of view of Chazal, was an ignorant guy who couldn't be trusted. But, you know, the times of the Tanakh, you know, if you were a shepherd, you had a good chance of being the leader of the Jewish people at some point. Why is that? Because a person in those days would choose to be a shepherd, to have time to separate himself from the hustle and bustle of everyday life, of being influenced by other people. You have time to go out there, be by yourself. You know, it's not, sheep are not very high maintenance. You know, you just kind of, you make sure they don't get into too much trouble. You have a lot of time to think and reflect. And, you know, a person would be a roed son because he wanted to have time to reflect and do what we'd call nowadays the sodadus, to be sort of alone by himself, connecting with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Such was the character of Hevel. He didn't just stam fall in to being a shepherd. You know, he opened up the want ads and saw, you know, okay, let's say computer programmer, mashkiach, local restaurant, shepherd. I guess we'll go with shepherd. No, it wasn't like that. He decided to become a shepherd because that gave him the opportunity to be a spiritual person. This, by the way, he doesn't quote the Rabbeinu Bechaye over here, but the Rabbeinu Bechaye, in his comments on the Chumash, I think by Moshe Rabbeinu, if I'm not mistaken, makes a similar point that, you know, it's not by accident that we find so many of the biblical leaders were shepherds. It's, they chose to be shepherds because that would give them a chance to focus on things that were spiritual.
Just focus on the fact that the nature of the animals also reflect on different things out there. Maybe on the, like, for example, you have bulls are very, very violent animals.
Right.
Somebody that's got a, you know, has a herd of bulls, he's got to deal with a lot of them. It's got to be tough and everything. So
right.
Have a character trait,
right.
Character traits of toughness, whatever. Sheep are very, very
docile, right?
Right, docile, very, you know, shapeful, very quiet, very
right. Able,
very
sweet. Right.
So,
right.
I guess.
Also, it works out very right. So, Rabbi Rubin points out, you know, that the sheep are very docile, you know, so if a person is watching after sheep, he's probably an edel person, he's probably a docile, you know, easygoing person himself. What about Cain? Cain, Ovid Adama, right? Cain was the person who was the farmer. He was working with the land. So says the Ksava Kabbalah, that indicates a preoccupation with materialism, the land. He wasn't interested in things that were spiritual. He was interested in things that were tied to the land. And he brings from the Targum Yonatan ben Uziel, Cain Omer, less din, v'less dayan, v'less olam acharon. Cain said, there's no judge, there's no judgment, and there's no world to come. So, you know, that's a pretty extreme statement to attribute to Cain. You know, why does the Targum Yonatan, where does the Targum Yonatan ben Uziel get this idea from, that Cain was a kofir, that he was a guy who denied the notion of a world to come? I mean, okay, look, obviously he had issues, you know, you don't just stop murder your brother, right? But on the other hand, you know, why do we see that there was a theological issue that Cain had? So the Ksava Kabbalah suggests it's from his very choice of profession. He chooses something which is this worldly, which is about as this worldly as you could possibly get, working with the land, working with this world. And the choice of profession indicates a lack of concern, or as the Targum Yonatan ben Uziel says, even a lack of belief in the world to come. Right? So right off the bat, says the Ksava Kabbalah, before you even read about them bringing karbanos, the very choices of profession indicate, you know, a different hashkafas olam, a different worldview that Cain and Hevel respectively have.
I just have a very, very understanding.
Cain's father
was created by the Rebbe Shlomo. How could the son already go off and be an Akkoi for not being
the Rebbe Shlomo?
Yeah. How is the child so close?
Yeah.
I mean, it happened. And that was
Yom HaShabbos
on Friday.
Right, right.
It all happened one day. Right. How is such a thing possible?
It's interesting, by the way, just on the second point, you know, when did the Maaseh with Cain and Hevel happen? So, again, there is one opinion in Chazal that it happened all on that same day, even before Shabbos. The Ksava Kabbalah quotes from the Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, where he says that the whole story with Cain and Hevel happened on Erev Pesach. Right? So as if we assume that the Bria took place, you know, on Rosh Hashanah, right? So the Maisa with Cain and Hevel happened half a year later. What is Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer writes in Perek Chof Aleph? Higia leil Yom Tov shel Pesach, right? The Erev Pesach came around, what would eventually be Erev Pesach, Yudalid Nisan. Omar Adam Levanov. So Adam Arishon told his children, "Beleil ze asidim Yisrael akrib karbonos bischayim." This is going to be a day on which the Jewish people one day are going to bring their Karban Pesach. Hakrivu gamatem lifnei boreinu. You also should go bring karbonos. In which case, according to that medrash, the incident with Cain and Behevel takes place about 6 months after the Bria, which actually fits a little bit the Lashon and the Chumash. Vayimi keitz yomim, vayave Cain mipriho adama mincha l'Hashem. It came to pass at the end of days, right? After days had passed. We know yomim, you know, in the Lashon of the Torah very often means a year. So here it wasn't a year, it was a half a year. But in other words, you know, it according to the Spirit of the Rebbe Lezer, it was not mamish the same day on which they were created.
Two things. Hashem told Adam Rishon that you should be over the Adamah because God cuts me up. He seems that this is what they were supposed to do.
Right.
And Yitzhak Avinu was a farmer too. He planted. So I don't see where the fact that Cain was a farmer
is a negative thing. Right, yeah. So I hear. I mean, again, you could add to that as well. I mean, Chazal say that the farmer is mamin v'zoreya, right? In other words, the farmer shows his belief in HaKadosh Baruch Hu and planting the seed and, you know, having the emunah that it's going to grow into something. I hear. I mean, again, I wonder if Aksava Kabbalah would say that this is a universal principle. Every time you meet a shepherd, he's a good guy. Every time you meet a farmer, he's a bad guy. But, you know, perhaps in this context, you know, being that they could have chosen to do anything, right? The whole world was open to them, right? Literally. The fact that they went in these directions right at the beginning of time, you know, maybe shows a certain inclination towards either things that were more spiritual or things that are more physical.
Why
didn't Adam himself bring a carpet? Why didn't he want to be mechanich them? In other words, you right, interesting. So maybe that's why it didn't work out so well, right? In other words, you know, it obviously didn't work out very well, right? So maybe the answer should have been Adam should have brought it by himself. Maybe that's the take home lesson. A little bit later on, the Ksav HaKabbalah writes that based on some midrashim and a Zohar, that Cain did tshuva, right? And as when he says Gadol Avoni Minaso, you know, my sin is too great to bear. That's actually an expression of tremendous regret. And the statement in Chumash, Lochein Kol Hore Cain Shivosayim Yukam. Therefore, the way the simple pshat of the pasuk reads, anyone who kills Cain will be punished sevenfold. That's not the way Rashi reads the pasuk, but that's the simple reading of the pasuk. Anyone who kills Cain will be punished sevenfold is in response to the tshuva of Cain. Right? He does tshuva, and therefore Hashem gives him a sign to protect him that he shouldn't be killed, even though, after all, he killed his brother. You would think on the surface that he should be subject, you know, if someone kills him, he's just getting his just deserts. Why does Hashem protect him? Because of the fact that Cain does tshuva. And that, says the Ksav HaKabbalah, just one last piece, explains an interesting pasuk, which we don't pay a lot of attention to, that comes a few psukim later. So, Vayhi Bona Ir, Cain went out and built the city. Vayikra Shem Hoyer Kishem Beno Chanoch. He calls the name of the city after the name of his son. Both of them were Chanoch. Why did he call his son Chanoch? And why did he call the city after the name of his son Chanoch? Right? Why focus on that? So first of all, before answering that question, Ksav HaKabbalah has a very interesting theory where he just raises the following question. What was Cain building a city for? How many people were there? Like, what kind of city was this? So he has a very interesting theory where he says the ancient people very often lived in caves. And when it says that Cain was building a city, it probably means not that he built a city in the modern sense of the term, that it means that he cleared out a cave for the family to live in. And he says you witness the fact that the Osios of Ir, are basically the same osios as me'ara, which means cave. In other words, the ayin resh are common to both. The word ear originally means a dwelling area. It's related to cave. And it's only by extension that we apply it to cities, because the original dwelling areas were caves. So it means he went, he found a cave somewhere, he cleared it out, set up a night table and a nice rug, put in some bookcases, and boom, now all of a sudden he had an ear, he had a dwelling place. So why the idea of Chanoch? So writes the Haksava Kabbalah, again, Kain did tshuva, and he sincerely regretted the act he had done in killing Hevel. So how would he maintain that posture of tshuva going forward? Lochein himtzi etzo benafsho. So Kain came up with the following idea: L'kro shem beno v'shem iro Chanoch. My son's going to be called Chanoch. The place where I live is going to be called Chanoch. The shame there, yiyelo laos v'simen tmidi lihazkiro shehu ketino kanitzroch elachinuch v'harugilus. The word Chanoch is related to the word chinuch. So this would be a constant reminder that because of the sin he had committed, he always needed more education and more rehabilitation for the rest of his life. He comes home, the sign outside the cave says Chanoch. He walks in, oh, little Chanoch, how was school today? The word Chanoch is on his lips constantly, where he lives, his son, and the constancy of the word Chanoch that he's always saying is always a constant reminder to him that he needs Chinuch, he needs to somehow keep re-educating himself in order to get past that terrible event that he had done. He lived with that guilt and that shame for the rest of his life, says the Haksava Kabbalah, which is the sign of a true Baal Tshuva, that that the awfulness of what he had done never really left him.
Yeah, I just understand what he said before, that he was mamish another curse, that he didn't believe in hereafter, he didn't believe in a Reishla.
He doesn't say that. He didn't believe in Olam Haba.
Oh, he believed in a Reishla.
Yeah. Right. It says less din v'less dayan. In other words, God's not a judge, right? He's not going to hold us accountable. There is a God, but less amud asti. There isn't a world to come. Okay, so Be'ezus Hashem, next week, Parshas Noach, we'll be back to the regular Wednesday schedule. I want to wish everybody a good Shabbos, and we should have a lot of hatzlacha in our learning of Haksava Kabbalah.